This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
As many of you know, I'm giving a number of different shiurim at the moment on different subjects. And I'll run through them just for those of you that are interested. Apart from this one, there is the Wednesday morning ladies' shiur, where we're studying the impact of women through the Tanakh, through the Torah. What the contribution of various personalities, various female personalities, has been. And learning the role, the place, the unique contribution that a woman makes in Jewish life through the study, through the textual analysis of the role of important women in the development of the Torah. And that's a ladies' shiur on Wednesday mornings. There's the Gemara shiur. It's an introductory Gemara shiur, which takes place just before this one, from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock. And then there's the Shabbat afternoon shiur, half an hour before Mincha, where we do the what, why, and how of some of the laws that appear in the current parasha that we're reading that particular Shabbos. That's the Shabbos morning, the Friday morning shiur. Friday morning at 7 o'clock, the what, the how, the why of various laws that appear in that week's Sedra. And Shabbos afternoon, half an hour before Mincha, an approach to Halacha, the understanding, the evolution of Jewish law, and how to analyze it, how to understand it, and how to apply it. These different shiurim are on different subjects and different topics, vastly different. And yet, the Torah is compared to a tree for many reasons, but one of the reasons is that one can be analyzing two different outcrops of a tree. One can be looking at two different branches of a tree. And one might be looking at something that appears microscopically very different. And yet one's really analyzing two parts of the same tree. And so it is with the Torah. It doesn't really matter whereabouts in the Torah one happens to be studying. One's studying one of the Sedras in the Chumash, one's studying another Sedra, one's studying the Book of Samuel, one's studying Jewish law, one's studying whatever area it is. If there is an integrity to the approach, then the same principles are going to be dealt with from different angles. And as one sees the same principles from different angles, one begins to gain a greater appreciation of them. Those of you who come to some or all of those shiurim will often see the linkages and the fact that although we're studying completely different texts and completely different issues, you will begin to see that the principles are very often the same that we're dealing with. And the area that we started dealing with last week is an area that we've also dealt with in a very different way, from a very different angle, at some of the Wednesday morning shiurim, and a couple of the others as well, and I'm going to synthesize them and expand them in a very important area that affects the way we, as I said last week, interface with the world. When we talk about relationships, we're talking not only about relationships. Somehow, nowadays when you say the word relationships, everybody thinks boy and girl. It's a shiur on relationships. What do people assume? It's about men and women. But that's only one of a myriad different relationships that we have. And the quality of the man-woman relationship is very much determined by the quality of all sorts of other relationships. People who have troublesome relationships with the world will have troublesome relationships between them and their spouses or their boyfriends or girlfriends or whoever it is that they're involved with at that time. It's very dangerous to isolate relationships and look at them only from the perspective of male-female relationships. That's only one relatively small dimension of the whole area of relationships. And what we began to see last week was some of the determining factors for successful relationship, not just between an individual, a man and a woman, but between a man and his world, of which a woman or a man is an important part. And understanding that and implementing it is an important part of the enrichment process. It's quite appropriate, in fact, we mentioned last week that we were looking for some additional sponsors. This shiur, we attempt to keep a high standard in the shiur. We attempt to keep a high standard of Torah, a high intellectual standard, and a high standard of ambiance, to have it in a nice place, to have some quality refreshments, to ensure that we attract quality people. We try and ensure that there's a certain air of quality to this shiur, and that costs a great deal of effort, and it costs money as well. And for that reason, we've had people assisting us to do that, not only by making a donation at the door, but also by sponsoring a shiur from time to time. But long before, we mentioned last week that during the period that we broke, that we didn't have shiurim for some number of weeks, we also broke the routine of acquiring sponsors, and that for the coming weeks we didn't have any sponsors. Long before that already, the sponsor for this evening's shiur had already come forward and identified, for certain reasons, this week as the week that she particularly wanted to sponsor. And that was Sharon Rosenfield. Who, Sharon? Lift up your hands so people know who you are. The lady who sits at the door, who's been volunteering since the first day we started the shiur, basically. And helping Elisa to sit at the door and help organize, get the place set up, and make sure that people can flow in readily. Chose to sponsor this shiur in the name of health and spiritual transformation, from a person who's taken the content of the shiur and made life changes based on what she's learned at the shiur. And this was her way of reciprocating, and we thank you, Sharon, for doing so. It's in studying the interface between man and the world around them, around him, around her, that the greatest potential for change in fact takes place. Change inside an individual that doesn't manifest in the way he relates to the world around him is not meaningful change. Change in the world around one that doesn't manifest in the relationship between oneself and the world around one is not meaningful change. And we see both of those types of change being pursued almost relentlessly. People constantly trying to change their environment, to redecorate their house, to get a new item of furniture, to get a new painting to hang on the wall, to move houses, to move location, to change the scenery, because that makes them feel as if they're changing. And on the other side of the spectrum, you've got the Oriental, the Eastern religious kind of approach of changing inside, changing me, as long as it then the rest of the world doesn't matter, as long as the change is internal, everything else takes care. Both of those are equally meaningless. They only become meaningful when the quality of the interface between the individual and the world around him begins to change. And that's the only change that's really hard. It's terribly easy to change the inside. It's just as easy to change the outside, to get a new suit of clothes, to go to an image consultant, and change the furniture. Very easy. To change the way we interface, that's the hard part. That the world should experience us differently on a consistent basis, that's hard. That we should experience the world differently on a consistent basis, that's hard. That we should be able to experience the same thing in a very different way, that's difficult. And that's really what this shiur is about. If we were to try and identify what these shiurim are about, yes, we're using the book of Samuel as our text, as the springboard of our discussion, as the anchor of our authenticity, so that we're not merely speculating, but that we're dealing with something that is firmly based. But if we're to look at what the subject matter is, what are we really talking about? What we are talking about is spiritual transformation. What we are talking about is the change that takes place in a person, not just in the way they feel, and not just in the environment in which they operate, but the change that takes place in the person in the way he interfaces with the world around him, with the environment around him. And the period that we're discussing in the history of the Jewish people is one of great transformation, which we've explained over the past weeks. A period where the Jewish people have opted and selected themselves to shift from a God-driven, miraculous system of government to a natural causality system of government. and there were reasons why they opted for that, and Shmuel is trapped in between this change. Shmuel still belongs to the world of the divine, the world that was supernatural, the world where causality was moral-based, morality-based. Where what happened in the world, what happened in certainly in the history of Israel, its economic evolution and development, its military evolution and development, its social evolution and development, was all a function of its moral stature, rather than of any other form of causality. And here the people have opted for a more predictable form of causality. And they want to be governed by an institution, the institution of the royal household, the institution of the king. And Shmuel becomes active in this transition, in helping the Jewish people through this transition. But it's going to ultimately require his withdrawal, because that's not what he's really part of. And last week we discussed the amazing speech that Shmuel gives at this particular point in chapter 13, in chapter 12, and a speech very similar in part to the speech that Moses gave before he died, where he challenges the people to identify anything that he might have taken from them, anything of their possessions that he might be holding. And we discussed last week the way the Chazal see it, the way the rabbis analyze it. That doesn't mean that he might have stolen anything from them. That doesn't mean that he might have borrowed anything from them without permission. That doesn't mean that he might have borrowed something from them and not returned it to them. That doesn't even come into the question. What we were talking about was any form of indebtedness. Was there anything at all that Shmuel had that could be accredited to the Jewish people, to the nation? And we contrasted that with government as it is today. Does government have anything that it has generated itself? No. Everything that government has is what it's taken from the people. Whereas Shmuel was able to say, in the time that I have governed you, is there anything that I have got that you gave me? I didn't take a salary, I didn't take housing allowance, I didn't take an entertainment allowance, I didn't take a travel allowance, and even when I brought sacrifices on your behalf, I paid for the sacrifices. So not only did I not run my government with any of your money, but on the contrary, what you have can be credited to me, rather than the other way around. And we discussed why that was so important in Shmuel's position. We talked about Shmuel as the judge, and the fact that although legally a rabbi, for example, is allowed to make a halachic decision that can radically affect his wealth, that he is trusted to make that decision in complete integrity, yet he's not allowed to sit on a court case in which a close relative appears, or a close friend appears. And there were cases where rabbis recused themselves from sitting at a court case at a Din Torah, when there was a person appearing who they had ever in their entire lifetime benefited from. The Gemara recites such cases. Not legally required, but there were cases where a litigant would walk in, and the judge would say, oh my goodness, 25 years ago, this person helped me when I was about to stumble, I'm not sitting on this case. And we dealt with the Chazanish's question, why then would the rabbis not be trusted, if they're trusted to make halakhic decisions that can impact on their own wealth so enormously, why can they not sit on a case that affects somebody they might have benefited from? And we discussed the statement of the Rimi Gash, where the Rimi Gash said so many centuries ago, that it's not that the rabbi was afraid that he might be tempted to find in favor of the person who had helped him in the past. What he was afraid of is that he might have to find against the person who had helped him in the past. And that there was a certain immorality to being the person who drops the stone in the well from which you yourself have drunk. Not a nice thing to throw a stone in a well altogether. Well, that might not be such a nice thing either. But to throw a stone into a well from which you have drunk is immoral. And if that's the case with a well, and we gave other cases of inanimate objects, where we're discouraged from doing that kind of thing. It's an immoral process. Although the outcome is irrelevant, the world can't feel it, the world doesn't suffer. But the process is an ugly process. To see somebody benefit and reject the thing from which he's benefited, even if it's an inanimate object, how much more so when that's a human being? And we spoke about that in some detail, in the necessity to recognize that. And we spoke about the different levels of morality. If we try and bring morality down to its lowest common denominator, we would say, love your neighbor as yourself. And then we said, but that's not enough. Hillel said, don't do to others what you wouldn't have done to yourself. That's not just don't. That's not the common denominator of morality is not love your neighbor as yourself. It's don't harm your neighbor. And then we said, well, let's go even lower than that and say, but at least show respect and appreciation to people that you've benefited from. If you're not going to love humanity, and you're not going to love the whole nation, and you're not going to love your whole community, and you're not even going to love your whole family, at least love the people who've done something for you. At least love the people who've had impact on your life. And we said, there's a level of morality even lower than that. And that is, if you're not able to love the people who've done you good, at least don't damage them. Just leave them alone. Don't do them good, don't do them harm. Just don't damage them. That's the lowest common denominator of morality. And we discussed what a wonderful world we would have if that's all we had. If there was nothing else in the world, no other Torah except that. No other morality, no other kindness, no other charity. That we didn't harm people who'd done us good. What a beautiful world we would live in. What a wonderful world we would live in. People went around being terribly careful not to damage anybody that they'd done good for. And it's interesting, that shiur last week aroused a great deal of emotion. Interestingly enough, the tape recording, as some of you know, didn't come out. There has to be some advantage to actually schlepping on a rainy night and being here. So I think that was God saying, those people who came on the rainy night, it turned out as we got into our discussion, it was a really important discussion, those who made the effort have got it. And those who rather stayed at home because it was raining, they've got the night at home. And they can't for $5 come and pick up a tape. It's gone. So occasionally God reminds us that we have to take advantage of things when they actually happen, not rely on canned versions of them. But it was an important shiur and quite an emotive shiur in people's minds afterwards, and a number of people came up with all sorts of different issues afterwards. And one of them saying, yes, I did benefit from so-and-so, but he's not a nice person. It's true, I benefited, but he's not a nice person. And I don't believe he's a good person. And I don't believe that he wanted to do me good. I believe he didn't particularly want to do it. As it happened, I benefited. So I'm not going to show him recognition. I'm not going to respect him for that. And I told that person the story in the Medrash, which some of you know, where Moshe comes to Yitro after running away from Paro. He saw an Egyptian killing a Jew, and he protects the Jew by killing the aggressor, the Egyptian, buries him. He hears that Pharaoh's heard that Paro has murdered the Egyptian. Moshe flees, goes off to Midian, stops at the well, and sees Yitro's daughters there and protects them from some molesting youths who were going to make their lives a misery. The girls go home. The father says, how come you're so quick from the well? These things normally take you longer. And they answer, this was an Egyptian man who saved us. And the rabbi said, well, why an Egyptian man? Do you want to say you couldn't tell that Moses was Jewish? Did they not know that Moses was Jewish? That would be quite an indictment on Moshe, that you couldn't tell that he was Jewish. Which is an interesting discussion altogether and ties up to our discussion of the Shabbos. And the Gemara says, Chazal say, no, when they said thank you to Moshe, Moshe said, don't thank me. Thank the Egyptian I killed. Because if it weren't for the Egyptian I killed, I wouldn't have fled. And if I wouldn't have fled, I wouldn't have landed up at the well. And if I wouldn't have landed up at the well, I wouldn't have been here to save you. So if you track the source of your goodness to its origin, it's Ish Mitzri, it's that Egyptian who set in motion the whole process that resulted in my being here. And the Medrash on that says it's like a man who goes down to the river because a scorpion has bitten him. And as he gets to the river, he sees a baby drowning, saves the baby and brings the baby to the father. The father says, thank you so much, you saved my child's life. And he says, don't thank me, thank the scorpion. All I did was what anybody would have done in that circumstance. Any person seeing a baby drown would save the baby. The amazing thing is that I was there. Why was I there? I didn't go for a swim. I went because my foot was aching, it was poisoned because I was bitten by a scorpion. So you owe the thanks to the scorpion, not to me. And I said to this person, if you've got to be indebted to an Egyptian who was murdering, if you've got to be indebted to a scorpion who was biting, don't come and tell me that you don't think the person who did you such good was such a good man. That's irrelevant. You're not making a value judgment on the morality of the man. You're making a value judgment on the benefit you've received. That's all. You've got to ask yourself one question. Would I be the same without that man? If the answer is no, I would not, you owe him a debt of gratitude. And the least debt of gratitude that one owes is to make sure that he isn't damaged. That's just how it is. But I want to take that concept a step further today, this evening, and deal with it in a situation which did not involve judgment. And this was the issue that came up in the late issue Wednesday morning, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, where there's one of the most difficult passages of Chumash to understand, and it involves a woman, and it involves her femininity, and that is Avram and Sarai, as they were then named, they were then called, had only recently come to the land of Canaan. They were settling down, building up business there, and a terrible famine hit the land, and they obviously lost a great deal of their wealth and couldn't stay there any longer. They had to go down to Egypt to try and find food. And Avram says to his wife Sarah, who's an elderly lady already, "Hineno yodati ki isho yufas mariot." You know, I've just noticed you're an incredibly beautiful woman. And when we get to Egypt, they're going to take a liking to you. And if they know you're my wife, they'll kill me. That's the only way they'll get to you. They wouldn't think of taking somebody else's wife, but they wouldn't mind murdering me. And therefore I'm going to ask you to tell them that you're my sister. Because if they think that I'm your brother, then not only will they not murder me, but they'll start taking great care of me to make sure that I'm well disposed towards them, so that if they ask for your hand in marriage, I will agree. That's the custom in the place. And that's the arrangement that he makes with Sarai. There's discussion in the Medrash Rashi brings why he suddenly at that stage of their marriage noticed that she was beautiful. It's quite odd that a man in his 80s or whatever Avram was at that time should for the first time notice that his wife is exceptionally beautiful. And Rashi says quite strangely that it was mitoch tzniyus shebishneihem, it was because of their modesty that he'd never noticed it. Now that's also odd. Modesty can be a result of somebody, can result in somebody else not noticing. Maybe. And we've had a number of discussions about what tzniut is, and we've discussed tzniut is not pretending to be ugly. Tzniut is not when a beautiful woman hides her beauty. That's not tzniut. Tzniut is the finest form of attractiveness. But it's a particular style, a particular type of attractiveness. So what does it mean because of their tzniut, because of their modesty, he hadn't noticed how beautiful she was? We discussed in the shiur on Wednesday that for the first time she was deliberately making herself attractive to outsiders. Coming to a strange land, she was putting on her makeup, straightening her hair or her shetel, and making sure that she was looking good, that when they arrived in this place, people would look at them and say, "This is an impressive couple." Not that these are a team of refugees and be sent to some kind of refugee camp. That's not what she wanted. She realized by the way she bore herself and the way she presented herself, that would determine the way they were treated. And for the first time, Avram looks at his wife making herself attractive for outsiders. And he realizes, my goodness, when they see this woman, they're going to go crazy for her, and my life's in danger. And we discussed on Wednesday, he didn't say to Sarai, "Sir, make yourself ugly. Take off that beautiful shetel and put on a tichel and put it on skew if you can and get that makeup off and take off your beautiful shoes and put on your these canvas Tisha B'Av shoes that we wear on Tisha B'Av." Here in Los Angeles, people like wearing them on Shabbos. But in most places where they're reserved for Tisha B'Av. And put on these walking shoes and denim jeans and get rid of the makeup, put your tichel on skew, nobody will notice you and we'll be safe. He doesn't say that. He says, rather tell a lie. You are beautiful. I want you to be beautiful. I want them to find you attractive. That's going to be our passport. That's going to be the first impression. They need to see us as an impressive couple. So that's fine. That you're making yourself beautiful is fine, but you're going to have to tell them that you're my sister. Fine, the plan works very well. INS people at the border identify her as a potential asset in the household of Pharaoh, and they arrest her and they take her straight to Pharaoh, to Paro. God gets quite angry that Paro plans to marry her, afflicts his entire household with various diseases. Paro realizes this is a message from God, calls Avraham in and says, why didn't you tell me she's married? Why didn't you tell me she's your husband? She's your wife. Avraham explains why. Paro says, please, get out of here. But he doesn't say just get out of here. He says, firstly, all the gifts that my people have given you, please keep. All the money that we have bestowed upon you so as to make you well disposed to us, so that you would grant your sister, who we now find out is your wife. So we gave you all of this money in anticipation of our being able to marry your sister. We now find we cannot because she's your wife. Keep it all. All that money, all that wealth, the camels and the horses and the donkeys and all the fine finery that we've given you, please keep it. And I'm going to arrange a grand motorcade for you to the airport. And Air Force One, if that's what they called it, will be waiting to take you back to Israel with as much money as you need to overcome the famine. And we discussed on Wednesday, why weren't they angry? Why didn't they say, you've deceived us? Why didn't they say, give us that all back? We gave that to you as for a reason. We gave you those gifts so that you would be well disposed to us because we thought you were her brother. We thought she was marriageable. We thought the king would marry her. That's why we gave you all this money. And now we find that you were a liar, you were deceiving us. Give the money back, give the property back, give the wealth back, and clear out. That's not what they said. They treated him with enormous dignity. And we explored why that was. And in doing so, I posed the question from a little bit further on. Same Sedrin, Lech Lecha. Where the king of Sodom, after Avraham has saved the king of Sodom from total annihilation, the king of Sodom comes to Avraham and says, well, you know, at the end of this battle that you've just won, you've gained people and you've gained money. Why don't you give me the people and you keep the money? That's how we'll split the spoils. Vayomer Avraham Melech Sodom. And Avraham, the same Avraham, says to the king of Sodom, Harimosi Yodi El Hashem Kel Elyon Kanei Shomayim Vaoretz. I hereby lift up my hands to the Lord, God who owns the entire world. Im michut v'atzreich na'am. Not from a thread to a shoelace will I take from you, or from any of yours. V'loy soima ani he'eshavti es Avraham. So that you will never be able to say, I made Avraham rich. I won't give you that pleasure. God will make me rich, not you. That's the same Avraham that goes into Egypt with his wife and says, tell them that you're my sister and then they'll give us lots of gifts. Is he a taker or is he a giver? We have two questions. The one is, why did the Egyptians not take the gifts back? And the second is, how did this Avraham, who was so meticulous about not taking anything that wasn't his, like Moshe later on, like Shmuel in our study, why was he willing to have this whole masquerade, not just to save his life, but also to become wealthy, and he keeps the wealth afterwards? When he has to reveal, I'm not the brother, I'm the husband, he doesn't even offer the wealth back. And they don't ask for the wealth back. He keeps it. Is that the same man? Has he gone through a personality transformation? We explained on Wednesday clearly. When Avraham was given all these gifts, what did he do? And what was the dynamic of his interface, of his relationship with the Egyptian people? Here we have the first case of a Jew as a Jew interfacing with the non-Jewish world. Not as a resident, but as a guest, as an immigrant, as a visitor. So for the first time we watch Avraham, the first Jew, interacting with the Egyptian nation. And at what level is he interacting? At royal level. Note. That's the level. The elite of the society is where he chooses to interact. Is that just by chance? Or was it by his active organization that that takes place? It's his active organization. If he said to his wife, look like a shloch, they would have interacted at the shloch level. He said to her, look like a princess. Is shloch an American word? Do they know it over here?
No.
They don't know it over here. It's not really translatable, but surely you can understand from the sound of it what it means. A real tramp, a schlep. He didn't. He said, look like a princess. Dress up like a princess. Make yourself up like a princess. And that will endanger us. So we'll work a strategy to avoid the danger. But clearly he positions her in such a way that he knows full well she's going to be taken to Pharaoh's household. She's going to be identified as potential for royalty. She knows that. He knows that. So they come into Egypt already identifying the level at which they want to interact in Egyptian society, at royal level. And that's where the interaction begins. So it starts off by them presenting themselves as noble people, as elegant people, as classy people, as people who have something to give rather than something to take. It's interesting, I've questioned customs officials at airports all over the world, including the United States, to find out who they pounce on. What do they decide? Why do some people never get pounced on and some people always get pounced on? What are the rules? And sometimes they speak, sometimes they won't. But they have profiles, as you know. And the profiles are dress, age, a few different things that they put together. And when they see it all coming together, that's who they go for. And the essence of it is, what they're judging is this person a taker or a giver? Is this person coming to invest or to steal? That's the issue. Is he coming to make his money on drug dealing, on money laundering? Is he there to take? Is he there for scam? Or is he there to contribute? And in a flash of a second, they make that decision. Very often they're wrong. But that's how they operate. The way you present yourself, and that's a whole portfolio of issues. The way you present yourself, the way you appear, the way you speak, what you speak about, the way you gesture, what you come with, all creates an impression which is decided immediately, has this person come to give or to take. And we all make that decision very quickly in our own lives. Person knocks at your door, you decide very quickly. Is this somebody that's going to be a pleasure to entertain or a drain to entertain? Is this somebody who wants something from me? Then the quicker I give it to him and get him out of here, the better. Or is this somebody interesting who I would want to keep here for a little while and talk to? Sometimes people come raising funds from us. There are people who come and as you see them at the door, you know there's only one thing they want. They want your money and to get away as quickly as possible onto the next client. And there are other people that come and you can see immediately, these are people who want to give you something back for your money. Who want to sit and share an experience with you. Who want to talk to you about something. Somebody you'll be enriched from. Somebody you'll gain from. We don't just classify them all in the same category. We also learn to differentiate. Somebody comes to apply for a job. Somebody comes to sell us a service or a product. Very quickly we decide, are they coming to make a difference to me or are they coming to take my money? What do they want? And we relate to them accordingly. And we make that decision within seconds. And the same applies when we present ourselves. And by we, I mean we as Jews. We as Jewish people, individuals and nation. We are always being looked at in that sense. Who are these people that they come to give or to take? Who is this person that they come to give or to take? It might not be formulated in those words, but that's what goes through the person's mind. Avraham and Sarah make quite sure that even royalty looking at them, identify immediately, these are people that can enrich Egypt. What's the response? They invest in the guests. What do you do if somebody knocks at your door and he's come for money for a yeshiva, clearly, that you see on the face, you see on the statue, this is the person you want to speak to. What do? You invite him in for a meal, you invite him in for a cup of tea, you ask him to sit down. you invest in. And so they did to Avraham and Sarah. They invested in. What did Avraham and Sarah do? Now comes the critical time. So the man who's come to raise money for his yeshiva knocks at your door. You identify him as a giver rather than a taker. You say, please come in, we're about to start dinner, won't you join us? He says, sure. Sits down at your dinner table, doesn't open his mouth, doesn't speak, shovels the food in, and then asks whether you can give him a donation. He's got to get to the next person before 8 o'clock. That's blown. The relationship is blown forever. What did Avraham and Sarah do? You've invested in us. You can be quite sure Avraham invested in Egyptian life far more value than anything they gave him. Every gift they gave him, knowing who Avraham was, knowing that Avraham was a man who said, I will never have it said that you made me rich. That means he always ensured that the other party was indebted, not him. That they owed him, not that he owed them. If Avraham was willing to take these gifts, how much he must have invested in return. And we see the proof of it at the end. They don't ask for the gifts back. They say, it's true, we gave you the gifts because we wanted to persuade you to allow your sister to marry into our family. But my goodness, we've gotten so much from you that now that we learn that she's your wife and that we can't marry her, we don't want the gifts back. This has been the best investment Egypt has ever made. The only thing is, we advise you to go for your own safety. For no other reason, does Paro say. It's not a safe place for you to be with such a beautiful woman. Go to a different place. This is not a place for you. And so we understand in Avraham, this is not to do with the issue we discussed last week of not wanting to harm somebody one has benefited from. This is a step further in saying, even if it's not an issue of harming, I don't want to be in a state of having benefited from anybody, because then I'm the indebted one. And I don't want to be indebted. There is a halakhic difference, and I explained this also on Wednesday, those who heard will forgive me repeating it, it's just so important and so beautiful, between two types of mikvahs. A mikvah is that important body of water that people immerse themselves into at various different stages in their lives. Women do it every month, men do it less frequently in the time of the temple, the Kohanim used to do it more frequently. The mikvah is used not only by women, it's used by different people for different reasons. But in all cases, it entails a kind of a regeneration, a kind of a rebirth, a kind of a transformation. That's what the immersion in the mikveh is. And there are two types of mikveh. There's a mikveh which we call a bor. A bor means a pit, a container. And there are certain laws that apply to the bor. One of the laws is it needs to have a certain quantity of water. There needs to be a certain mass of water. The water has to be rainwater originally, natural water. And the water must not be flowing. The water must be stagnant at the time that one immerses in it. So for example, in a mikveh, it's terribly important not only where the water comes from, but where the water is going to. If there's a leakage in the plumbing and or in the drainage system, and there's a very slow, it can be a minute seepage from the mikveh, during the time that the person uses the mikveh is invalid. It's as if you didn't go to the mikveh altogether. So mikvehs have to be maintained. But there's another kind of a mikveh called a be'er mayim chayim, a source of living water. That is water that's connected to a source, a spring, with no breakage in between. The water is directly connected to its source, to the spring. There, it must be flowing. Not it may be flowing, it must be flowing. And there is no minimum quantity. It doesn't matter how much water is included in it. Even if it's a very small amount of water, it is still a valid mikveh. Why the difference? There's an enormous difference between nature, even though it's natural and therefore authentic, that is contained to nature, something authentic that is generating. When one is generating, quantity is unimportant. When one contains, quantity becomes very important. When one receives, quantity is important. When one gives, quantity is less important. One gets pleasure from giving little things too, more than one gets pleasure from receiving them. in receiving, the size of the gift is important. In giving, the size is not that important. When one is not earning money, it is important to have a lot of it, an enormous amount. In fact, almost no amount is enough. Even very wealthy people who are not earning become quite insecure about their money. They can have millions and millions and millions in the bank, and there's still a level of insecurity. When a person is earning, even if he doesn't have that money, he's less insecure about his money. It's coming, it's generating. There's more where that came from. He has a sense of confidence in his own capacity to generate. The Torah gives tremendous value to the power of generation, to the creation of something new, the creation of new ideas, the creation of new money, the creation of new generosity, the creation of new relationships. Enormous value is given to creation, to creating new things rather than storing the old. And so Avraham makes sure that at every situation, he's not the borrower, he's not the container, he's the generator. No matter how little he's got, that he's generating, he's giving. His environment is indebted to him, not him indebted to his environment. We started on that last week. There are people who look at the world as a source from which to take. There are people who look at the world as something to which to give. There are people who look at the world as something which owes them an entitlement. There are people who look at the world as the vehicle for my self-expression, the vehicle for my giving, the vehicle for my projecting myself, for my making an impact, the vehicle for my contribution. Because the human being gains security from the value of the contribution he makes rather than the value of what he takes. There is no security in taking. There is enormous security in being able to generate, in being able to create, in being able to contribute. So when we talk about the difference between good relationships and relationships of goodness, people talk about, I want a good relationship. What do you mean? What is a good relationship? Do you know what most people mean when they say a good relationship? I want a relationship with somebody who will give me everything I need. Relationship with somebody who will give me everything I need. That's what a good relationship is. And they wonder why it doesn't work. The two get together and they're both weighing each other up in terms of, can you give me everything I need? And the other one's looking at him saying, can you give me everything I need? And the more they look at each other, they get meaner and meaner in that look. You can see it in their eyes. And they start noticing the meanness in each other's eyes. And then they say, oh, no, I'm not having this one. And off they turn and they go on to the next one. Nice, happy they meet each other. How are you? Shalom Aleichem. The smile's good. And then starts the evaluation process. Can you give me what I need? Can you give me what I need? Mean little eyes. No, thank you. And off they go. And that's how we conduct our relationships. I described the networking evening to you a few weeks ago. That's how we conduct our relationships. Always looking at each other in terms of, what can you give me? And you can see it in the person immediately. That's the bor. That's the bor, which is the pit. It's the bur, which is also a word used in the Mishnah, connotating an empty person, a taker, a drainer. And it's an English word too, which comes from that Hebrew origin, a bur. That's the bur. And you can have very sophisticated burs. They can be graduates of Yale and Harvard. A bur doesn't necessarily have to be an uneducated person. A bur is the person who walks into a room and looks around it to see what he can get. That's the bur. And the Be'er Maim Chaim, the living spring of water, is the one who walks into an environment and says, what can I do to change this place? What can I do to make it better? What can I do to impact on it? What can I do to express myself in a unique way that will leave something of me in the hearts and minds of everybody here? That's how he looks at the world around. That's a relationship of goodness, not a good relationship. We all look for good relationships. We look for good jobs. What's a good job? A job that gives me everything I need. We look for good parents. Good parents give me everything I need. We want good children. They do what I tell them to do and they give them. Well, they give me all the nachas I need. We all want good things around us and we define goodness like the book. What is good? Whatever gives me what I need is good. What is goodness? Anything that allows me to give what I need to give. That's goodness. And that's much more rare. To find situations, to find people
that facilitate my being able to give what's good for me to give. Not to give what's bad for me to give. Sometimes people give the wrong things. To be in an environment that gets the best out of me. That gets out of me what I should be giving. That's a relationship of goodness. And that's an Abraham. And that's a Moshe. And that's a Shmuel. And Shmuel's warning to the Jewish people at this point of their transformation is, you've had, he says in all modesty, a leader who is a prophet, a leader who is a tzaddik, who is a righteous man. You've had a leader who is goodness. And what you've asked for now is a good king. And what you mean is a king who will give you whatever you want. And I'm warning you now, you've just lost the king of goodness. You might have gained a good king. In fact, you've gained the best king there could possibly be. But it's going to be nothing like what you've lost. You've lost a relationship with leadership of goodness. And you've gained a relationship with a good leader. But that's a fall in the whole status of the relationship between leadership and the people. And it's that fall that he describes, that fall that I'll illustrate to you in greater detail next week. And it's that fall that we will start with all its greatnesses too, because there's so much greatness in the coming chapters too. There's so much excitement, there's so much dynamicism, there's so much real life. It becomes more real as we go. This is more closely related to us. We find it a little difficult to relate to the prophetic character of Shmuel and to that supernatural kind of existence. We're moving into something which is much more akin to our own. The relationship with Shaul, and later on the relationship with King David, much more passionate, much more human, much more full of flaws, of the flaws we recognize and we can relate to. But we need to understand what's been lost in the process and what they're going to need to try to recover. They're going to need to try and recover in a framework of politics and power play. They're going to have to recover some of the sweetness, some of the goodness of the relationship that they used to have with the divine. Not only seeking the humanity in God, but learning how to seek the godliness in humanity. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Are there any questions for a few minutes, and then we'll have Kaddish, and then we'll have refreshments. Yeah.
Other than knowing Abraham's character, what other indication is there that Pharaoh acted out of gratitude rather than fear?
Why would a man who controls the most powerful empire in the world be afraid of an old Jew and his wife?
Well, because the reason that God afflicted his household.
And the reason that God afflicted his household, he actually states, is because he realizes he was about to marry a woman who wasn't available for marriage.
Right, so he has a fear of God.
Right, absolutely right.
Right, so my question is, other than Abraham's character, how do we know that Pharaoh was acting out of gratitude rather than fear of God?
You're right. I guess one doesn't know that for certainty. One would expect that that there was nothing. It would have been nothing immoral about asking for the gifts back. Relating to Abraham's wife, that was immoral, and he understood why God was punishing him. There was no reason to assume that God would punish him for doing something that is fully within his rights to do. And saying, "Gee, we gave you and we invested in you on the basis that you had a certain ability to reciprocate. You haven't delivered. So please, can we just get back to where we were before you arrived, and off you go on your happy way?" There would have been nothing immoral in that, so there's absolutely no reason that Pharaoh should have been afraid to do that. But you're right, we don't have an absolute proof.
On a metaphysical level, this is to be important for the future of the children of Israel leaving Egypt with great wealth. So Egypt is playing out a program. Pharaoh, at least at some level, may not have known why he was doing it.
Now, that we can't do that. That's where when one gets into dangerous ground, with the greatest of respect, of learning too much too soon. you know almost too much in some areas and not sufficient in other areas. That is true, and this does pre-play a program that is going to be played later on, but that in no way detracts from the capacity to make moral analysis and judgment of each action as it happens. Even Pharaoh, later on with the Jewish people, was playing out a program. And you and I are playing out a program. But it becomes very dangerous if we start relieving ourselves of moral responsibility because we're playing out a program.
So that we can't do. We're fully entitled to examine that event and work out what is the psychology that drove that event. Certainly within the family environment, before an individual leaves the family environment, brothers, sisters, parents, there's plenty of opportunity to give, and an obligation on the parents to train the child in that capacity to give. And then in society, the person's in a job, he's meeting friends, he's with people, there are opportunities to give and to take. Every second of life there's an opportunity to give and to take, animate objects and inanimate objects. You can give and take in every interface. We're not just talking about man-woman relationships or human relationships. In every interface and in every interaction, either the energy is from you to the world or from the world to you. If the primary energy is from the world to you, you're taking. The primary energy is an output of energy, you're giving, you're generating. That's all the time. There was one question here, I think. And the last question here, and then we'll do a break.
Yeah, so
the
twofold here. One is regarding...
Can't hear the question.
I'll repeat it in a moment.
Okay. Does the end justify the means? In other words, you know, the end of getting what you want justify his, why? And then, as his example for us, is the lack of intent considered a lack of integrity or acceptable to life?
A complex question which really we need to treat almost for an hour on its own, but very briefly, the first question was, does the end justify the means? On what basis did Abraham lie? And there are two aspects to that answer. The first aspect is, he didn't really lie because, as we learned a little bit earlier, which we didn't do tonight, he in fact was a very close relative of Sarah. They were cousins. Elise, I think she was. They were very close, and in the Torah, brother and sister, and in many cultures, brother and sister is not always a literal brother and sister, but a close family member. So he wasn't saying, she's not my wife, he just said, she's my sister. Or she said, he's my brother. They were quite careful about that, to minimize any chance of deceit. But nevertheless, they were misleading Pharaoh. And they were intentionally misleading. And ends justify means only when life is threatened. If you have to tell a lie or break Shabbos to save your life, you do. That's one of the very few cases where an end is allowed to justify a means. Almost any means, not all means, but almost any means, if life is in a state of being threatened. Clearly not. Clearly that was the only place where there was a source of food for them, a source of income for them. Otherwise they would have. Egypt, from every point of view, was the least attractive place for them to go. And the one fraught with the most threat to their spiritual and physical survival. So one would think if there was anywhere else within reasonable distance, they would have gone elsewhere. Although they might have had the same problem almost anywhere they went. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we'll end it there for this evening.